the presence of any one brain, I think, is a bad thing. So if you're very left brain, then of course it's a problem for your right brain. And if you're only right brain, then good luck for you, because you'll not even know how to count. So I do think that there is right now a little more of a left brain focus, a hard data analytics, all of that, you know, stuff, which basically affects us, and we actually leave money on the table, and we have consumers also pissed off because of that. So I have like hundreds of stories, even from yesterday, two stories from yesterday. It's on the fact that we continue to be a lot of what is called default setting being left brain versus default setting being multi-brain.
Welcome to Prime Venture Partners Podcast, a podcast for entrepreneurs looking to build and grow their startups. Learn about uncommon strategies and common traps from makers and doers of startup ecosystem.
Welcome to the Prime Venture Partners Podcast. Today, I'm delighted to have with us Vivek Sundar. He runs food delivery at Swiggy and is the chief operating officer there. Thanks, Vivek, for being on the show.
Thank you, Amit, for calling me. This is an absolute pleasure. I've been a listener of your podcast. To be on the other side is truly, I'm still pinching myself.
Yes, not at all. I think you're being too humble and modest, and our listeners will figure that out very shortly. Every time I have spoken to you, I've learned something. So I'm kind of kicking myself as to why we haven't hustled and got you earlier. So maybe, Vivek, we can start a little bit with your background in terms of what led you to coming to Swiggy. I know you have a very varied background. You worked in FMCG, you worked globally. So maybe just a quick snapshot for our listeners in terms of how you ended up at Swiggy, and we'll go from there.
I guess the lure of a fast-paced, well-run startup that is blitzscaling or on the precipice of blitzscaling is a very strong one for anybody who's been on the other side. And as you know, the grass is always greener on the other side. When you're in a large company, you realize that you've got the skills, but you're effectively like a person who knows how to drive a car in the fifth gear, but for some reason, either the handbrake is on or the car is on the third gear. So I think because of that fact, most people realize that, hey, listen, I can go to two gears faster, or I can basically work much better without a hand gear. And so if you were to just look at that professional analogy, that's the executive summary of why one wants to move. You have the skills, but somehow you're not able to do what your skills can make you believe. So basically the gap between actualized potential and real potential as you look at yourself is perhaps the reason why the lure exists. And frankly, meeting Harsha and all the investors was truly the reason I joined. It's not like I have not met other companies around the world. There's always something that sort of doesn't click. You know, either the company is at a late stage and therefore it's sort of not really a startup, or it's too early and they can't basically make best use of my skills, or there's something which is a values mismatch. This just happened to be the Goldilocks test, right? Everything is right.
Absolutely. And I'm sure you've also been a big part of the success, not just the founders, once you've come on board. So maybe just a quick bit, you know, one is always very fascinated with P&G and companies like that. Like you said, the grass is greener on the other side. I've always been in tech and product and internet businesses. And I've read a few books. I don't remember the one from one of the, I think, founders or CEOs of P&G. But, you know, what are a couple of the things that you learned at P&G over your career and in general? And then what are some of those that you've been able to apply at Swiggy and Swiggy Delivery?
Yeah, so first of all, it's a wonderful school. I would say that P&G is the best MBA that you can have if you don't have an MBA, because it teaches you pretty much, doesn't assume, by the way, in the interview, think about it, Kotler is practically full of P&G example, which is the marketing handbook in business schools. And yet in not a single question ever in the history of P&G would you be asked a marketing question in the interview, like five rounds of interview, not a single marketing question, not a single sales question. And so on and so forth. They believe that if we get people with the right values, the ability to work hard, they're smart enough to be able to do the analytical work that is needed, we can hone them on the rest. And I think that means that there is a very first principles approach to attacking problems, which I think is immensely useful in becoming a versatile manager. And I think that's something which P&G helps you to do, right? Because it's a large enough tent to give you the multi-format, multicultural abilities that are needed. I'm sure if you look at the best cricketers, You will find that they are good home and abroad. You will find that they are good in test, one day, and D20. I mean, it's not surprising that Virat can play all three, right? And that multi-format, multicultural abilities is something I genuinely believe will need it for business people, and PNG teaches you that. The multi-format could be, and multicultural is obvious in any place. You've got to work in places where there is very high e-commerce business and places which are very high traditional trade. You've got to work in cultures which are, you know, very different across the world. So I think that versatility is the first thing I would say PNG teaches, because its first principle starts with the consumer and works backwards. So all of the famous, you know, aphorisms of start with the consumer and then work backwards is literally drilled into you. You don't, I mean, the metrics are almost, you ignore the metrics and focus on the consumer. And I'll maybe talk some examples of how ignoring the metrics and focusing on the consumer gives you insights, which in hindsight, of course, is 2020. But when you're going hard at a problem, often a very left brain analytical company, which lots of Indian startups tend to be, they just miss out on that.
No, I definitely want to double click on that as we go along. But before we do that, how was the transition, right? One of the questions we often have, both for our companies we invest in at, as Prime, as they scale up, and we're looking to get, you know, senior, you know, star talent like yourselves, is how will the culture fit work, right? And obviously it is, you know, it is going to be played out with both hands, right? I mean, the person who's hiring you or the company that's hiring you has to put an effort to make you kind of be successful. And you also have to adapt, right? You know, 15, 20 years at PNG is not going to be like you'll just fit in, you know, in hand and glove on day zero, right? It might take a little bit of time. So can you talk to us about that aspect of you know, your journey at Swiggy, and how would you recommend it for other people who are looking to get folks like yourselves?
Sure. So I think this. I mean, the sort of one-line summary is you're moving from a place where, at least in my case, I was moving from a place where the products were fast-moving to a place where the people were fast-moving, right? So, that's one thing to keep in mind. But on a more serious note, I think that, and if I were to think a little bit about what I've seen, I've obviously spoken to a lot of folks in the startup ecosystem over the last 3 years, spoken to folks who are on the other side who are wanting to come. My sort of tips, and I'm sort of still learning as I'm speaking. I don't think I have a full encyclopedia, but I think the first thing is to a lot of the younger companies is don't hire if you're not ready. I mean, it's not, and then ready here is either financially ready. I mean, if you're a startup which is in sort of seed stage and so on and so forth, you know, there's no point in hiring somebody like that. They're going to be useless and they're going to be too expensive, right? You also have to be sort of emotionally ready to give up. You know, it's like no mother who's got an infant is going to engage a teacher for that child. But a mother who is having a preteen is perfectly fine to go and look for the best music coach or cricket coach or anything like that. So, you know, when you're bringing in somebody who's got the expertise at scale and a different order of expertise, you have to be emotionally ready to let the child go. Right. So I think that those two things, you know, if you're not financially or the business isn't ready, and if you're not emotionally ready, don't hire. I mean, there's no, it shouldn't be a badge of honor to say that, oh, you know, I've hired these amazing people from these amazing companies. You're essentially just hiring a very expensive millstone around your neck. And the second thing to keep in mind is, look, if you wanted somebody like the people that you started the company with, which is, you know, young people, lots of hustle, maybe a little chaos, you know, but obviously fantastic problem solving and so on and so forth, then, you know, you're doing the wrong thing by hiring somebody like that. They bring in different skills. And therefore, you have to hire when you want to effect some kind of a change. And that change could be reducing the chaos quotient and increasing the sort of reliability quotient, or scaling to a place which you are not familiar with. And that place could be either a geographic place or a consumer segment place, or a new segment of businesses as well. I mean, if, for example, Ola was moving from what it originally used to do to manufacturing, surely it needs different skills on manufacturing. So I think about the change you're planning to bring into the company, either the core business or a new business, and bring in that change. The second point of it is, look, at the end of the day, I'll speak a lot in sort of analogies and similes. it's effectively like an organ transplant. Okay, maybe even if you're bringing in a heart or a kidney or something, it is an organ transplant. So to say that the organ that is being brought in has to change is true. Of course, we do prepare the organ for the transplant. We don't just say pluck it from one body and put it in the other. You sort of, you have to check for blood and so on and so forth, but you also prepare that organ. But equally, and this is something which I don't think startups do very well, which is why the mortality rate for people like me is so high. They don't prepare the body for the transplant. I mean, if you have a friend who's had an organ transplant, they're actually preparing the body to not reject the organ, because the default setting of the body is to treat the organ as a foreign object and sort of, throw it away. There are your own white blood cells will basically start to kill that organ. So I think preparing the body for a change, and I'm saying body because that's the larger entity. You're a single person joining a startup. Preparing the body for a change is very important. And I think that many people sort of realize later that and then we say culture mismatch and culture fit and so on and so forth. I mean, you went in for that person. You knew that person is coming with a different culture. So what's so surprising about it? So I think that learning from these other places where we naturally think of preparing both the recipient and the donor is part of it. I think that that's the second tip I would give you. There are very good books available. There are also practitioners available in the market who can prepare the body for a change. In this case, the company for a change. The other piece is that you have to think a little bit about the impact the CXO is going to have. Is that he's basically going to take the energy and the passion and the missionary zeal that already exists in this company, which is why it's done well enough to go and hire a CXO. And he's going to take all of this raw material and say, I'm going to basically make it happen at 10x scale or 100x scale or 200x scale, because that's what he's used to. It's a very normal thing for him to basically be operating at 100x scale, right? So very simply put, I mean, when I first came in, I started talking to Swiggy, I think we were in 8 cities or something. And pretty much everybody, the founders, the investors were like saying, India, we don't know whether an internet business really has a place beyond 50 cities, right? And this is, remember, back in 2017, end of 2017. So now I come from a place where essentially 800 million consumers use the products that I was selling before this, right? So urban, rural, all 3,000 class one towns had a PNG product and deeply distributed. So to say that this business has a business which is sold for 300 rupees, a natural, normal business, which people always go out and eat, has a role in only 50 cities was like alien to me. Like, really? What am I missing here? I mean, I go to these cities all the time. People are eating out all the time. People have smartphones now. They have students are there. They actually aspire to do what their cousins in larger cities do. So what part of it? So it's very natural for me to think that this business should be in 1,000 towns. Right. And the experience that I would have had actually made me know what those 1,000 towns were and all of that. So I remember saying this thing. I said, look, guys, I'm not understanding this. There are at least 800 towns in this country where there is a meaningful business of washing machines. And I'm not talking about washing machines that basically make lassi. I'm talking real washing machines. Right. And I said the washing machine signals two things. One, of course, income and propensity to spend, which is an equivalent of, let's call it household income or household propensity to spend. And second, the feeling in the family or the psychology of the family to exchange some of that disposable income to give relief to the wife of the family, to the housewife of the family, which is the truth in most of the... So I said, when you take those two things together, which is disposable income plus willing to spend money to give some relief to the wife of the family or the primary caregiver of the family. Swiggy is a version of that. When you're replacing the Markahana with sometimes Barkahana, that's really what you're doing. You're having a little bit of a treat and also you're giving, in some cases, the mother a break. So I said, I don't know why we should be in only so many towns. So we did the following. We said, okay, let's dump all the data of the people that have downloaded the app and we have just said to them, sorry, not operating in your city now. There were 700 towns that people had downloaded from and said, and we had said, sorry, we're not operating. They're not just downloaded, they had registered. That's a very high intent to buy. You don't put in your phone number and address and all of that thing. So I said, guys, there are 700 places where they're doing that. 500 of these places the number of consumers is over 2,000. I said, we're going. There's enough market research and data that exists that we are, that they are, that we can do the business with that. So I think that scale is natural in people who run businesses at scale. Sorry, long story, but I thought I should explain that.
Yeah, no, I have a lot of questions I want to sort of double click on, but I think this will make a good, you know, transition to the kind of the Swiggy journey and what you've learned about consumer behavior, about the market, which you already started talking about. But just one quick sort of, not even pushback, but thought on the previous comment, right? Which is about, you know, I got your point about don't hire too prematurely, right? You're setting yourself up for failure. Don't hire without the culture fit and the getting the, you know, body and the organ both ready for it. Yeah. But oftentimes we also find that, and maybe this is more true for early stage than later stage, people will just keep holding on to it, right? And therefore it becomes too late to kind of get people in, right? I mean, and I am a, you know, practitioner of product management and engineering and so on. The founder wants to be the product manager for 12 years. And, you know, there's a point where you go, look, you know, either this is not going to work or something else that you're supposed to do as CEO or co-founder or whatever is not happening, right? Or maybe you're not the best skilled person, like you said, in the case to expand from 10 cities to 800.
Yeah.
So what is there any just quick thought on that before we jump to Swiggy about hiring too late as well, just like the inverse of the premature hiring that you talked about?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I'm sorry, I did think it was a incomplete answer to say don't hire too early. I actually truly believe that if you hire too late, then maybe the, you know, staying on the medical analogy, then, you know, that organ which basically needed a transplant has just made the rest of the body suffer. I mean, sort of stretching the analogy here, but you're absolutely right. So there is an appropriate and optimum time to bring in, and it, maybe it is a sweet spot, whether it is Series X or Series Y, I'm not getting into, because that depends on the scale of the company and the nature of the space it operates in. Also, it, I think, depends on how fast is the learning curve of the sort of founder himself or herself. But I think that maybe too late is when a certain sort of rigidity has set in for that company, that this is just how we have done stuff. This is why we've been successful so far. And actually, more importantly, more rigidity, not on this is why we've been successful so far, because, you know, kudos to you for being successful in where you are. More the rigidity on, oh, we've tried this stuff and it doesn't work. I think that's the rigidity which becomes very difficult for anybody coming in new to deal with. And I think in many cases, the advantage I had was that Harsha had his own doubts, but he just stayed out of it. I mean, he would tell me privately his concerns and so on and so forth, but he would stay out of it. So most of the people who were actually having to do this didn't hear the sort of, you know, bird on the shoulder saying, but we have tried this before and it's not worked and stuff like that. I think that was an excellent sort of behavior. And this is part of the whole preparing the body. So I think it is before the rigidity sets in. I don't know whether there's a good way to measure this. I think there's a, maybe there's an, I'll use an inversion sort of theory. Every 6 months, because things happen fast in a startup, every 6 months, you got to ask yourself the question saying, if everybody in the, I mean, founders will play different roles, like somebody will be a CTO, somebody will be a CPO, somebody will be a COO and so on and so forth, right? CFO, et cetera. I mean, I guess they end up choosing CFOs relatively easily. I don't know too many founders who double hat as CFOs that easily. But I think you have to ask yourself the question saying, if this company was hiring a CXO, whatever that's XB, would it hire me? And the answer to that question, and by the way, you shouldn't ask yourself that question because you'll have all positive and negative biases about yourself. Some people may be too humble and say, no, of course, I'll never get hired. And some people may swing on the other side. You should basically actually have a formal sort of almost a search committee saying, would it hire me? And if the answer to that question is no, like unequivocally no, then you should basically say, I'm sort of screwing this baby up by basically doing that job.
Absolutely.
And again, it's the same story on cricket. Let's be honest. I mean, I know how to play better cricket than my son right now, but I'm going to be a shit coach. So I should quickly get out of the way.
Yes.
Get out of the way and let him learn from a real coach, because I know I'm better than him because, of course, he's much younger and so on and so forth, but I'm not going to be a good coach. So I know that fact that me getting in the way of letting him not see a quick coach early is actually, in a way, not me being a good father and not loving him. If I love him so dearly, I should let him go to an expert.
Completely agree.
I mean, in completely that sense, the Gurukul system almost facilitated that, right? It says, look, don't assume that a parent is going to know so many things. Just send him off and you know, you'll find that he's going to learn much better, because your true love is when you actually make that person learn even better and make you better than you. So I think, you know, I'm sort of mixing a lot of these things, but I do think that your point about thinking about when it's too late is an equally valid one. And maybe we make mistakes on that side too.
Absolutely. So let's talk about Swiggy. And, you know, you obviously are responsible for Swiggy delivery, but you also spend a lot of time thinking about the Swiggy customer experience, right? And, you know, what should the ethos of Swiggy be? You also obviously have a large team, I'm sure. So you're sort of influencing them and kind of guiding them and coaching them and so forth. So talk to us a little bit about, you know, the customer journey that you imagine at Swiggy, and, you know, what are the things that you guys have implemented, and, you know, some lessons learned perhaps that could be useful for startups.
Sure. So the first thing which we want to say is that we have made more mistakes on the customer journey than we care to note. Literally, we could write a litany of it. I kid you not. After this podcast, I actually have my CX team in here doing postmortem, and not RCA, not root cause analysis, postmortem. The patient is dead. Now let's understand why it's dead on a few things that we've gotten wrong. So I think in a fast three-way marketplace where real time, it's real time and it's hyper-local, we make more mistakes than we are happy with. So this is not a company who's sort of Six Sigma yet. We would like to move towards that, but we're not. That's one big caveat we want to state. In fact, this is part of our core focus area for 2021 recovery is that. I think some of it is because of the fact, so I'm going to actually not talk the whole shebang because we could spend the next 4 days talking about it, but I'm going to give a very incomplete set, but an interesting, in my opinion, set of reasons why this happens. One is that there is a belief in the company, stated or unstated, that customer experience is about trade-offs, right? Agar main usko achha customer experience dunga, which is if I give the person a great customer experience, I will have to trade off either growth or more relevantly, unit economics and profitability, right? Sure, I mean, in theory, that's true, and therefore there's nothing wrong with it. But often enough, this becomes the guiding belief that says the reason why we are not doing customer experience is because of the trade-offs that we have had to have, and there is a financial goal to be met and so on and so forth. And I think that's because of the lack of either sophistication and creativity in the financial modeling, or the lack of the belief that actually, you know, if you're creative, you can actually create better customer experience and do it at lower cost, right? And so there are a few examples that we have where actually that trade-off has worked in a sort of a negative way, right? We believe that if a customer gets really bad delayed orders or whatever, that's a bad customer experience. Sure, you would agree that that's the case, right? And therefore, we in some cases say that we'll trade off growth by basically constraining the radius during Sunday night when there is an absolute chaos out there, right? The orders are peaking like crazy. You just can't have so many people complaining about delays. So let's constrain the radius and trade off the growth, because if you constrain the radius, then less restaurants are available, less orders and so on and so forth, because we want to preserve customer experience. Now, sure, that sounds logical, but the question is there are some customers who may actually not mind waiting for an hour. But we don't ask, right? We don't say, hey, listen, this order is going to take an hour and a half because the restaurant is absolutely chock-a-block. Would you still like to wait for it? No, we just constrain it. And when we constrain it, we have said, oh, see, we made the trade-off that everybody likes a fast order or a fast enough order. And therefore, let's shrink the radius. Therefore, let's basically constrain growth, give up some orders in order for us to basically give that. Now, that's bonkers. There are some customers, surely, who will be willing to wait that long. Not everybody is, you know, jumping like a cat on a hot tin roof to say, Khana, this minute manachi, right? So that's something which we will figure out a way of how to basically deliver win-win, which is that, yeah, those who are willing to wait, you know, have it. Cost is another classic one. We actually spend a lot of time in thinking that if we have to get a delivery guy to do better service, you got to pay him. So if you pay him a lot more, then more of these delivery guys will come, and therefore they will good service. So my cost for delivery is going up, and therefore customer experience is improving, right? So it's sort of a trade-off. But the reality today is that we have actually run a few experiments where we have actually made the delivery partner focus only on one metric. Forget all of the other metrics, just focus on one metric, make the customer happy, right? Doesn't matter when you press this button, that button, how many minutes you took, this, that, and the other, we'll deal with that shit. You just focus on making the customer happy. Right now, in the sense, by actually giving him only one metric to focus on, he thinks his job has become easier. Because today he has to worry about 1,000 other metrics. Was I there when I'm where I was supposed to? Did I press this button? Did I reject the order? Did I accept this order? All that complicated left brain stuff. And so we basically changed that. And in certain zones that we are actually running, we are having a win-win. He's not asking for more money because we've given him only one thing to focus on. So I don't have to give him any more incentives because it's one metric. And customer is happy. And so you're actually having a situation where the cost hasn't gone up and yet the customer is happy. And I think this is where, again, we sometimes take what is a generically true statement and apply it as a sort of rule of life. And I think that's sort of linked to a point, which is a pet observation of mine, which is, I mean, both of us are sort of coming from an engineering heavy background, but have moved into more of the product and consumer side things. I think this, by the way, the presence of any one brain, I think, is a bad thing. So if you're very left brain, then of course it's a problem for your right brain. And if you're only right brain, then good luck for you because you'll not even know how to count. So I do think that there is right now a little more of a left brain focus, a hard data analytics, all of that, you know, stuff, which basically affects us. And we actually leave money on the table and we have consumers also pissed off because of that. So I have like hundreds of stories, even from yesterday, two stories from yesterday. It's on the fact that we continue to be a lot of what is called default setting being left brain versus default setting being multi-brain.
Got it. No, I love that point about the one metric to focus on. Truly the North Star, right, is a happiness metric for the delivery agent. And I can connect it to hospitality, where I spent a few years of my career, you know, at the Oberoi hotels. That is the North Star metric, right? Make the customer happy. Of course, that's a much higher end, lower volume kind of play than the scale that you guys are both delivering and aspiring to. But, you know, the Nordstrom and the other examples in the US of very customer-centric companies, everything else just flows from there, right? So that is great. I want to talk a little bit about this left brain, right brain. How do you, in an inherently analytical left brain engineer turned entrepreneur or engineer turned MBA turned COO kind of culture encourage right brain thinking, right? Easy to say from the rooftop saying, okay, let's think right brain, let's think customer empathy. But are there any practical tips that you have perhaps or things that you inculcate to bring about that thinking?
So I want to say one interesting observation, which is because the default setting of the brain is left, doesn't mean that there isn't that it basically means the right brain is a muscle that's sort of semi-atrophied, but it, with exercise, it'll come back. It's not dead, right? It's just a little atrophied. That's my observation, which is some of the smartest product managers that I've worked with here or business leaders that I've worked with here. Once you have sort of opened that or pushed open that door and shown them what's possible, they've truly, truly tried to make it a new habit to exercise both sides of the brain, right? And of course, over time, it comes in. And, you know, that's why I was still talking to you about in PNG. Of course, you respect both sides, diversity of thought, as it were, as opposed to just visible diversity of gender and race and stuff like that. So that's one very heartening trend, which is that while we don't have it, it is a muscle that can be built. It is not one of those problems that, yaar, mere paas to right brain nahi hai. That doesn't work. It is, everybody has got, we hire people with enough what is called versatility to do both. And I just wanted to lay that out there because otherwise people will think I have to go and hire from some obscure school. And
I agree.
Some other compromises. None of that is needed. But let me first start with some couple of anecdotes. And I'm going to try to make this a little more long-winded. So apologies for that. But let me ask you the question on, I mean, you've probably used credit cards when you've gone out to a shop. And I'm sure it's irritating when when the guy swipes your credit card and it doesn't go through and you have to enter your PIN again or whatever it is, right? It's irritating. Now that metric in our digital world is the payment success rate, right? You have gateways and so on and so forth. Now, it is logical to draw a straight line correlation, pretty high R square, on the fact that the higher the payment success rate, the higher the customer satisfaction. So far, so good. Why would you disagree with that logic that says something that is a improving trend should lead to a payment success rate? So now we have our payment success rate, unfortunately, is not determined just by the quality of our engineering and our code and our systems, but also the gateways, right? I mean, there is an external partner out there that we have to deal with. So our payment success rate is, let's say, X percent, right? Now, obviously, the team has been told, go guys, go hard at it. And I mean, there is a person who's responsible for that. And he's a really smart guy. And he's been tasked to go and get PSR to be as close to 100 as possible. Now, of course, he's sitting there and thinking, how do I do that? Because it's not in my control alone. There is all these various payment gateway partners and real life of what happens when their systems fail or they have a failure at that, their end, and so on and so forth. So he's basically been scratching his head and how to try to make this to as close to zero as possible or 100 as possible. And that's, in my opinion, taking what is a completely valid statement, which is the lower the PSR, the more the customer detraction or dissatisfaction, and the higher the PSR, the higher the customer satisfaction, and basically taking it to the extremity that therefore perfection is 100 and customer will be truly satisfied only when it's 100. But the right brain person says, hang on, if Amit goes to a store and he enters his card and he types in his PIN and the person says, sir, the payment didn't go through. Let's be honest, he's mildly irritated, right? He enters it again, it goes through, he probably doesn't even remember it, okay? However, if Amit enters and the number of times that he has to keep entering crosses a certain threshold, irritation starts setting in. Kya yaar, teen bar enter kar diya, char bar enter kar diya, kya ho raha hai? Aapka machine mein gadbad hoga. I don't want to waste my time. So it is not one failure that causes that to happen. So in the PSR model or any engineering metric model, Amit having 4 consecutive failures in one transaction versus 4 Amits having a failure is mathematically the same. It's payment success rate.
Yes.
That's one. The second one is, now imagine a world where Amit has had one failure and he's got an SMS that says 2,000 rupees has been deducted from your bank account. And then the merchant says, sir, payment didn't go through. I haven't got the money. You'll have to enter the PIN again. Amit's not mildly pissed now. He's super pissed. Like, boss, mere jeb se to paisa nikal gaya. What are you talking about? The money is in my account. So I don't know why I should be paying it. No, sir. Here is the proof. Here is the chit that you can keep. It shows it's canceled. In 24 hours, you'll get the money back. And you're sitting there and thinking, dude, you're not even the bank. How are you committing to me that the money will come back? It's my headache that I have to follow up with the bank if indeed it becomes a double transaction. Which means what? It is not PSR that actually is the determinant of customer. So if you basically go back and look at this, it will tell you that no, there is a lot more nuance than this, that hard metric of PSR that's causing Amit to go apeshit crazy. Right? Understanding that means that you will actually put a system in place that actually measures consecutive failures of Amit in one transaction differently from either Amit having 4 failures in over 4 months or 5 different people having these 5 different failures. One time failure, nobody really cares much about. So they will differentiate what the metric itself will change. And number two, if the payment failure is accompanied with a debit, then if you put a system in place that says, sir, in 24 hours, I'll make sure you get your money back. Else I'll deposit this much money into your wallet. If you make a commitment of that nature, and let's say you were to make good that commitment, Amit says, wow, this is a reliable place. I've never had a problem beyond 24 hours. When they say they're going to make good, it makes it happen. Now, it's a real example from 24 hours ago. But now if I tell you that straight line correlation of a PSR to customer and so on and so forth, yeah, of course it's true, but it's not true to the extent. So this is an example where understanding what drives the crazy chemicals of anger, irritation, frustration inside the human body is what needs to be put into a metricized form and then to basically be driven. And I think that's, therefore it is in the sense bidirectional brain or sort of both sides of the brain to be applied. This is a real story. Another real story, which is true for us, is back in the COVID lockdown time period, you know, whether it was real or not real, people were spooked not ordering food. The food is going to give me COVID. The packaging is going to give me COVID. The delivery boy or girl is going to give me COVID. So why the hell should I even order in from outside? I'm going to get COVID. Was the reason why we had massive dormancy. People left the platform. Okay. Over 80% of the population did not order, even though they were stuck in at home and they couldn't go to the restaurants and order because they were spooked. Okay. So of course, as we said, what is the reason people are spooked? There is a scientific reason why people are spooked. They feel that they're going to get COVID from these 3 places. So let's invest in serious technology, left brain, to convince them that, boss, your fears are unfounded. So temperature checks, you know, tying up with medical firms and proving that you can't get COVID by basically touching the food, right? Hot food, for example, or basically doing contactless delivery. And to be fair, all of it moved the needle to an extent. But here are the facts. We only got the 20% actives to move to 40% active, which means 60% was still dormant. COVID spooked. We used to actually call them COVID spooked dormants. Okay. So now if you left it to the standard operating procedure, they would have just said, work harder at it, man. It's doubled in the next 3 months. Just keep working harder at it. Convince them. Send them more information. So we created a docket, I'm not kidding, with one of the medical service providers that was a scientific explanation of how COVID does not get transmitted through this. Classic left brain. Have a problem, go solve the problem. Okay. The needle barely moved. And then we went behind and said, look, let's just understand from the consumers who have finally ordered. Maybe there are 2% of the consumers who finally ordered after 3 months. Let's go and understand what tipped them over to order. Was it the fact that they said, nahi, aapka wo maine document padha tha. It's a great document. I read it. It basically told me that at this temperature, it doesn't happen, blah, blah, blue, blue, all of that. Okay, if that was the case, it would have been proof to continue pressing that accelerator. The guy said, no, actually, you know, my neighbors were also ordering and it's been 3 months and they haven't got COVID.
I love it. I love it. And now I can tie it back to your TV commercial, which I saw exactly. many, many times.
Exactly. So this, by the way, in pure behavioral science, it's called social proof.
Of course. Yes.
So we said, look, guys, we can keep trying this left brain, you know, convince them and bombard them with information. But people are going to first say, I'm not going to read this piece of shit. Secondly, you are biased. You're of course going to tell me it's safe. You being Swiggy. So we said, cut this. Let's just do social proof. And if you saw the IPL TV commercials, they were all about social proof. Are you? Mehraja ne bhi order kiya, Sharma ji ne bhi order kiya. Nothing scientific there. Literally not a single thing we had put in there was scientific. If you notice, it was devoid of any science. Okay.
Yes. And I remember that.
Now, of course, there is a little double whammy effect of IPL and of course, and so on and so forth. But remember, cases only started coming down in the last 3 months. Through IPL, cases will still rising, right? In India. IPL meaning I'm talking October, November, September, October, November of 2020. Essentially, the number of these spook dormants that came back was 2x that came back when we did a scientific campaign.
Great, Vivek. We are running a little over time, but I'm loving it. So I'll probably bother with a couple more questions as we wrap up here. So you said something very interesting about your first observation around going from 50 cities to 800, right? And I wanted to unpack that a little bit later in the show here. So can you talk to us about some new consumer behavior that's emerging in the rest of India beyond the top 10, top 20 metros, which might also be beneficial to other entrepreneurs, even outside of food, who are looking to tap these markets, right? Because we've always been India heavy. I mean, call it SEC, SEC, AAB heavy or India one or whatever you want to call it, right? The first 50 million users, depending on the company. Yeah. So can you maybe give us some insights of in what ways are Indians changing or the rest of India changing, which could be useful for new entrepreneurs?
Sure. So a couple of sort of caveat. First, we are in 550 cities. 800 is potentially what we could get to.
But yes, of course, I understand. Yeah.
So we're in 550 cities. So I'm giving you some stuff which I think a lot of your people will know. So it's maybe a bit of a repetition, but I'll say that just for completeness, which is the whole point around, you know, people have what is called a functional understanding and knowledge of the English font, but they still tend to use the local. If you actually go to a small town and see an auto rickshaw driver, he's not reading any English newspaper. He's reading a vernacular newspaper, right? So it's perfectly fine for him to go to a place and fill up a form which actually has it in English because he can functionally read the English script, but that's not what his natural script is. So to assume that the same format, cluttered, lots of English sort of UI will work when you actually start going down the city pyramid is a bit of a stretch. Now, what it means is, sure, for the top 5%, top 10% of students and, you know, younger people, it'll still work. You won't even notice the difference. But the moment you cross the cream of that city and start going down, it doesn't work, right? So you've got to think a little bit. And it's not just the vernacular versus non-vernacular difference. It's the simplicity of the UI versus the complexity of the UI that you have to think about. And again, this is something which I'm sure people are aware of. But this is one of those things which is very important. The second one is an interesting thing that I had picked up. Whenever I used to go and open up, by the way, being in PNG teaches you this stuff, you get very nosy, you open up people's cupboards and kitchens and pantries and see what's in there because you just want to see what's their behavior, right? So we do the same with phones. When I go to these small towns, I said, "Apna phone dikhaiye, let me see the apps that are in there," and so on and so forth. And one of the things you will find is that their WhatsApps are less with stuff that they have typed out, because let's be honest, it's not easy to type out in Hindi, and more about voicemails, the voice messages that they've sent out. So they're recording stuff and sending it to their friend because then it's an asynchronous message that the person can listen to, which is very rare. I mean, you and I have WhatsApp so many times, but we haven't sent each other a voice message. So given that voice is much more natural a way to talk to people, We think that thinking about an interface that takes in voice and gives out voice may be actually better than something that is very reading heavy. Again, something as an insight that people are aware of. I mean, Google, of course, talks about it, that the NBO may actually be coming in voice and so on and so forth. So thinking a little bit about how do I have to interface with this consumer, both the language of it, the format of it, the UI of it, is an important variable as you go beyond the students and the digital literates thin layer across these 500 cities. Right? The second thing which we often make a mistake of is that there's less money there, right? I'm sure there's less money there, but actually they are bigger value seekers because they have more time and they're willing to therefore trade off the time for getting a better deal, right? So if you actually offer them a chance to get a better deal, they're willing to do the trade-off, right? It's not like they are unwilling to spend their money. They're just willing to wait a little longer to get a better deal because they're not that time stressed. So your promotional campaigns, et cetera, have to be thought through very differently. You know, most of us think that, oh, you know, a big jumbo coupon is only useful for a very rich consumer. Sure, there is a space for a jumbo coupon for a rich consumer in a big city, which is, you know, an 800 rupee order or a 1,000 rupee order. But for these guys who may tend to either have larger families or may actually tend to order in a group because social behavior is much more common, it may actually become very useful for them too. So it actually has two purposes. Classical nuclear family, rich, urban, metro town dweller who's basically buying a large amount because he's spending an expensive restaurant coupon, different from a person who's basically ordering in large amounts. Like, I'll give you an example. In Jodhpur, there are no samosa orders that we have seen that are below 10 samosas. I mean, one has to think that the reason, mirchi bada samosa, et cetera, et cetera. Now, one has to think a single samosa, whereas in Bangalore, you will have people ordering two samosas and stuff like that, right? Now, part of that reason is because if you order only two samosas, you're actually not getting a good discount because you're sometimes below the threshold of needed to get a good deal, right? So these guys understand that buying large is basically getting a discount. So you've got to think a little differently about the discounting campaign. The third one is if you have your company set up in what is called set forms, then you will basically have the norms of what is acceptable, rigid, right? And the way to look at it is just like, maybe not to get too scientific about it, but time flows different. I mean, Einstein said it different famously about, you know, being with a beautiful girl versus sitting on a hot oven. Time doesn't seem to pass the same time at the same rate. The same thing is true. What is 35 minutes in a big city may be equal to 42 minutes in a small city. So if you set up your ecosystem to say anything above 40 minutes is a bad order and therefore configure your system, you're just putting arbitrary cost onto yourself. It's good enough. He's fine to wait another 7 minutes, give it to him there at that point of time. You don't have to then carry that load of less volume, but high cost in those cities, which then becomes a millstone around your neck. So, I mean, nothing, I think in hindsight, everything you'll say is obvious, but I think we just, when companies expand, these are all configurations that unless you change, you'll just basically put the same configuration out there and say, see, I told you these cities don't respond very well.
Great, Vivek. I think we could go on for hours, but you know, we'll try to wrap up and be you know, maybe just end with one short answer to this question, because I know you're a very avid reader. I think you do photography. We'll include the link. I saw that beautiful picture in the National Geographic in the show notes. But maybe a book or two that you would recommend, or one that you've gifted very often to people in the professional kind of sense.
Of late, I've gifted Alchemy, which is a book by Rory Sutherland. He is obviously a guru on behavioral science, and he's written a very easy to read book. And I think it's a book that basically teaches people how to think about the irrational consumer and apply behavioral science in real business situations. Obviously, Nudge is also a very good book, but Nudge is a lot more about the actual, what Thaler won the Nobel Prize for, as opposed to Alchemy, which is a lot more, it's about creating, as you know, yes. Nothing. So Alchemy is a recent book that I've gifted a fair bit.
Thanks a lot, Vivek. It's been delightful. Lots of insights and really appreciate you being on the Prime Venture Partners podcast. Thank you again.
Thank you, Amit. A pleasure being with you.
Dear listeners, thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast app for free, and you'll be the first one to know when new episodes are available. Just search for Prime Venture Partners Podcast in Apple Podcast, Spotify, CastBox, or however you get your podcasts. Then hit subscribe. And if you have enjoyed the show, we would be really grateful if you leave us a review on Apple Podcast. To read the full transcript, find the link in the show notes.